This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith. In this Radio EcoShock show, you will learn how the Arctic warming emergency is changing your weather. But first, the story of an anti-pipeline media warrior in his own words. Are you sick of hearing about the tar sands pipelines from the Gateway Project to the Keystone XL? Maybe you should hear from the people who are sick and dying from a leaking pipeline. I'm calling up John Bolenbaugh. He's a decorated Navy vet now qualified with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He's trained to clean up spills. John was hired after the Enbridge pipeline in Kalamazoo, Michigan, had the biggest inland spill in United States history. That was on July 25th, 2010. But the cleanup and the story are far from over. John, you became a whistleblower. Why?
They were burying oil in my backyard, right in my community, so I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't let it happen.
Well, they claimed to be cleaning it up. What were they really doing?
There was so much oil that it overflowed the river and went into the swamps. And we're talking about 40 miles on both sides, approximately 1,000 foot into the swamps. And it was too massive of a cleanup. And they were losing about $8 million a day, because the government said you cannot turn this pipe back on until you have most of this cleaned up. And so they started covering a lot of it up because they were losing $8 million a day, approximately.
Well, how did it go on for so long without somebody finding out about it?
Oh, well, there was a lot of workers that came forward and made complaints, but they didn't want to lose their jobs, so they wouldn't go public. And I was basically the only whistleblower that risked his job, lost his job, and lost his career for this.
And when did you alert the press?
It was 2 weeks before I was fired. I went to Fox 2 News, and this is about 2 weeks after I went to the EPA. EPA didn't do nothing. They knew that Enbridge was covering up oil. They were signing off on these areas saying they were clean when they weren't. The EPA is just as much at fault as what Enbridge is. And I went to the press after the EPA wouldn't do anything, and that was October 1st. It was Detroit News, Channel 2. And then I told Enbridge on October 14th, which was my birthday, they said an area was clean and we were done with it. And I went up to Dave Murphy that worked for Enbridge, and I said, you can't do this. This area is full of oil. I'm going to the EPA again. I'm going to go back to the press. And I'm going to report to them that you're lying to everybody. And the next morning, Dave Murphy told SET Environmental, my subcontractor, to fire me.
You know, I've seen a lot of your videos on YouTube, and they're really revealing. And it looks like this big pipeline company uses the local police like their own private security company. Did they arrest you for taking videos from the public roads? And how is that possible in the United States?
Well, yeah, I was arrested. It does seem like these police officers are ran by these oil companies. Right now in Arkansas with the Mayflower spill, you have Exxon that has the EPA and the DEQ stationed in the Exxon building. So the local press and media does not have access to even talk to the EPA because Exxon refuses to let them in their building. And they have a no-fly zone over the lake, which they actually said there was no oil in the lake. They did nothing but lie down there, and that's what happened in Michigan. This is going to happen in several of these pipeline states in the next few years because tar sand oil is like sandpaper on the inside of these pipes. And I've been investigating this for a while. All these welds are wearing away, and all the pipes that have busted and we have these major spills, they all break right on welds. That's what's happening. All these tar sand oil started coming through a lot of these 60-year-old pipes about in the same five-year period. So possibly in the same 5 to 10 year period, you're going to have major spills nonstop. The only way to change that is if you have brand new pipes. And even with brand new pipes, like, let's just say the Arkansas spill. They said they shut it off in 16 minutes. Nobody tells you that they have pump stations that are 50 miles away on each side of that leak. So if that area is at a bottom low area, you're going to have gravity that's going to let 50 miles of oil come through that pipe even after it's turned off. There's nothing you can do about it.
Well, people picture it as just oil going through these lines, but it isn't. What do they have to do to keep that bitumen sludge moving along?
Well, on a viscous scale, our normal car oil is about a 5 or a 6. Tar sand oil is an 11. It's not even on the viscous scale. It is like peanut butter, molasses. It's super thick. The only way you can get it to go through these pipelines is with high heat and pressure, and they have to use hundreds of toxic chemicals to make it thin out and flow through that pipe. And we're talking about benzene and toluene, hydrogen sulfide, octane, dectane, methane, propane, I mean, just on and on, chemicals that are very poisonous to our bodies. And when there's a spill, tar sand oil doesn't flow. So when it goes into waterways, it sinks right to the bottom. And the only way to dig it out is you have to actually drain the whole area, dam it off, and dig it out. And they try to get away with this. I just costed Enbridge here in Michigan, a year after they said that it was done, they could allow the kids to swim in it. You could eat the fish out of it. I took National Public Radio out there. I took Scott Roberts from CTV out there. I showed them the oil that's at the bottom of this river after they said you could swim in it. So then they put pressure on the EPA. So the EPA has no choice but to cover their butt. And now they're telling Enbridge, through a court order, you have to re-clean up this river, and it's going to cost them about $150 million. And that's all because of me and taking the press out there. Enbridge hates me.
And what kind of health effects are people feeling in Kalamazoo after this heavy bitumen spilled?
Well, as I said, benzene is so toxic, and toluene, and hydrogen sulfide. Now, I'm actually a victim of the spill as well. I lived within 1,000 feet of the river. I should have been evacuated. We had gas masks. We were never told to wear them, and the companies lied to us. And what we have found out, that these chemicals we breathed in were thousands of times the legal limit, and they were super, super toxic, and a lot of these people were never evacuated. For one, the company lied and said it was a different type of oil at first, a more non-toxic oil. They lied and said it was a 200-foot evacuation, even though the documents in our training book say it's a 1,000-foot evacuation from a large spill. And they tried to get people to sign off their rights, and they would give them an air purifier or an air conditioner, give them $200, and say, please sign this document saying that you received this. Well, guess what? The document at the bottom said that you waive all your legal rights. And so they were tricking these people. And this is why, this is my goal. I'm trying to go around the country and give speeches just to inform and educate people when there is a spill in your backyard, what you can do to protect yourself and your health. We have hundreds of people that are having seizures, that have passed away, birth defects, miscarriages. We have thousands of people that are having migraines. I just had an MRI myself and a CAT scan because I'm having migraines. I'm dizzy all the time. They found blood in my urine. They're saying that my kidney levels are elevated way too high. And this is all because of the chemicals that I've exposed myself to trying to prove this cover-up. And I feel so bad for our community because there's a lot of people. My great-uncle just passed away a few days ago from what we believe is a blood disorder he got from the oil spill.
My. Did Enbridge check the air as well?
Well, Enbridge actually sent a letter to the EPA the day after the oil spill, and they said that they did 100 air sample tests. They said that there was zero benzene to be found. Now, they didn't say there was some. They said there was zero at 100 different locations. Now, the reason why that, it took me 2,000 documents of reading to find that document. And the reason why it's so important is because EPA on the same exact day did air sample test, and it was 15 parts per million. Now, you're only allowed to be around benzene that is one part per million for a 40-hour work week, 8 hours a day. Now, these people were breathing these toxic chemicals in 24/7 for days and weeks, and super illegals. I mean, I can't even believe they didn't evacuate them. But these companies have a lot of money, and they have a lot of power, and they've did this for many years, and they know how to get away with this.
Well, John Bolenbaugh, you went out to Nebraska to help folks who were worried about the Keystone XL pipeline crossing their land. What did you find there?
Well, come to find out that TransCanada has – I actually worked on the first TransCanada pipeline, and that was in South Dakota and North Dakota. Well, come to find out, they're trying to go through Nebraska right next to the aquifer. And I thought to myself, that doesn't make sense. So we did some digging and found out that, for one, TransCanada is – the majority of TransCanada is owned by China, by 16 different companies that own TransCanada. Then you have 80% of all the tar sands China has purchased. So basically, China has to find a way to get this oil to China. They can't do it through Canada because you have the Indian nations that own the property, and they're stopping that. But the issue now is they're trying to put it through the United States. And most of the tar sands is all refined in the United States because Canada won't refine it because the carbons are too high. And that's what it is. In Nebraska, they just want to put this right next to the aquifer because we actually found documents that suggest that TransCanada or China can tap into the aquifer and pull out water if they need to. So what if 10, 15, 20 years from now, when water is scarce and it's worth a lot of money, that China sucks some of our water out of our aquifer? And in the worst case scenario, let's say we have a spill in Nebraska in that aquifer. We just lost 30% of the United States water if we have one spill. And we know that they don't have a good track record. The best of the best pipelines that they've ever built had 14 spills in the first year.
In one of your YouTube videos, a Nebraska woman says pipelines leak even when they don't have an accident. They can leak 1.5% of the whole load, and they don't have to report that. Did you know that?
Well, I knew that, but I didn't ever know I'd never seen the documentation, because sometimes I talk to workers and they secretly tell me things, and they say, John, I can't be on video and I don't want to lose my career. But this was the first time that someone showed me documents, and it was actually on the TransCanada site. And it says that they do not have a detection system that will go off, the alarm system will not go off, unless there is a 1.5 to 2% pressure decrease. And because of that, let's just imagine this is a 500,000 barrel pipeline a day situation. And if we're talking about a low amount, 1%, you could have 1% of all that oil leak out, which is 5,000 barrels a day, every single day leaking out of that pipeline. And nobody will ever know because no alarms will go off. This can get into your wells. It can get into the aquifer, creeks, rivers. I mean, your kids could be drinking this for years and you would never know because no alarm system will go off.
Not until the cancer shows up or other health impacts, and then I guess you'd know, but of course the company doesn't come clean about it anyway. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Michigan pipeline activist John Bolenbaugh. Well, John, what else have you heard about that big Exxon pipeline spill in Arkansas recently? Was that bitumen from Alberta as well?
Oh, yes, and they tried at first to say that it was Wabasca crude, which, if you know anything about this, that comes from Canada. It is a tar sand oil. And it means a lot, because if you know that it's a lesser type of oil, you don't have to evacuate as far. If it is a tar sand type oil, you have to evacuate 1,000 feet from wherever the oil reached. Now, Exxon tried to say that the oil never made it to the lake. The reason why they don't want people to know that it's in the lake, even though we found out later that it is because those people can have a lawsuit. anybody that's hooked to that river has a legitimate lawsuit if it's in the river. So what they try to do is say it never made it, it never made it to the lake, that they stopped it in the cove. Well, we had the attorney general from Arkansas tell us that the cove is the lake. So for Exxon to say that they stopped it at the cove, he said that doesn't make any sense because it's all the same body of water. But the reason it's PR, they don't want people to know this publicly. This is a huge stain on them. And they just got the silver medal for oil companies saying that they have such a great oil company when I just went to the Yellowstone spill in Montana, and I just proved that they didn't clean that one up properly from a year ago. I'm going to go down to Arkansas here next, here in a couple weeks. I have some big protests here in Michigan. And as soon as I'm done with these protests in Michigan, I'm going down to Arkansas. And if anybody can afford to help me, I would appreciate that.
Well, we'll talk about that. I know you do need some help to keep campaigning the way you are. I've heard a rumor that Exxon doesn't have to pay the bill for this Arkansas cleanup because technically it wasn't oil, it was bitumen. I'm not sure that's true. Did you hear anything about that?
Yeah, that is true. Bitumen isn't part of their oil tax revenue. So I think it's 8 or 9 cents per barrel that you have to pay if you're an oil company for regular crude. But if it's bitumen, you don't have to pay into this. And that those taxes go for a cleanup. So what happens when you have a bitumen spill, that these oil companies don't have to pay for the cleanup. And I've learned through my investigation that these oil companies do not want to fix these old pipes. They are going to wait for the spill to happen. And this is why. If they close down that pipeline for 1 week and they're losing $8 million a day, right, that's $56 million that you have lost in revenue. So what they do is they just wait for it to spill because they knew in Michigan the pipe was bad for 5 years before the spill. Then once the spill happens, the insurance company will pay the oil company to come clean up their own mess. So now they're making profits from that. They also will fix the pipe, and the insurance company is going to pay for it. So now they saved all that money. And all the workers now have a job, so the oil company employees are happy. And you have all the companies around the country raise their gas prices. And they'll raise it 20, 30, 40 cents, saying that there's a shortage of oil. Well, guess what? The insurance company pays for all the lost revenue from the oil spill. So it's ridiculous for them to even say that they have a shortage of oil because our number one export in the United States is oil. That's the number one export. So if we're exporting so much oil, why do we have a shortage? It doesn't make sense. And this is all about profits. They don't care about us.
So the leaks, I mean, nobody loses. Everybody makes money. It sounds great. So they might as well just wait. It sounds a lot like the nuclear industry. They're just waiting for those old reactors to blow up because they don't want to spend the money on fixing them. So what's your take on Obama? Do you think he's going to approve the XL pipeline? And what happens if he does?
He's going to approve it. And we just had 50,000 people show up at Washington, D.C. Trying to stop this. I believe, in my opinion, that Obama and these politicians are run by these companies. And no matter how much they want to do the right thing, they're not gonna. I think they're bought. I think they're owned. Just like Harper in Canada. I talked to one of his cousins just here in Florida when I was doing an interview with an oil worker, an environmental inspector. And she said, yeah, I'm cousins with Harper. And her exact words were, I cannot believe he's doing what he's doing, but I believe his life is threatened. That's the only reason he could be acting like this, that he's been threatened with assassination or something. And I believe that those are possibilities when you're talking about billions of dollars. I do believe that Obama will put it through. I'm a union worker, everybody. My entire family works for oil companies. My brothers, my cousins, my dad, my uncles, everybody. And I am an unemployed union worker. But I've seen the devastation from a tar sand spill. I would rather be poor than work for a tar sand pipeline job. I will never do that for the rest of my life. I don't care how much I'm offered. And I was making about $2,300 a week. These are good paying jobs. But you have to understand that this XL pipeline is only going to have a couple jobs when the pipeline is put in. You're only going to have jobs for a year, and there's only going to be maybe a 1,000 jobs. I work for these companies. I know the figures. They're lying to everybody. And it's not logical for us to put this pipeline in, risk our air because we're refining all this tar sand oil. We're risking our water and aquifers, and we're risking our health. For what? We can't even tax this. Why? Because it goes to Port Arthur, which is a tax-free zone, and because of that, we can't even tax it. And we're giving them billions of dollars in subsidies and different things just for letting them put in these pipes. So we're basically paying them to pollute our country.
And you went and sold your own pickup truck and a lot of other things just to spend your own money to make signs, to protest, to get out T-shirts to people, to get out and spread your message. You must be broke by now, are you?
I've spent every dime I got. I don't even have a car right now. Thank God my girlfriend lets me use her vehicle to do interviews and protests and things. Yes, when I was fired, I spent every unemployment check until they ran out. I've sold everything I've owned. I've spent about $35,000, and I never asked for a donation for 2.5 years. And the reason why is because I wanted people to realize that I was in this for the right reasons, because there's a lot of ways to do things for the wrong reason. And I needed to prove that to myself and to everybody else that this ain't about money. This is about doing the right thing. But now I'm at a crossroads. I'm with the love of my life, and she needs time to spend with me. We have bills, and it cost a lot of money to travel to Arkansas to go give a speech. It cost a lot of money to go to Nebraska, in Montana, in Texas, in Washington, D.C., and in the Gulf, and travel around to these oil spills and give speeches and stuff. It cost a lot of money. And I have a lot of interviews that I need to do with scientists and professional people so I can make a documentary out of this. It cost a lot of money. And I don't have any more money. So do I quit? Because if I quit, I cannot help everybody in Canada with the Northern Gateway Pipeline. I can't help with the XL Pipeline. I can't help with Line 9 going through Michigan all the way to Pennsylvania so that way they can send it to China. I can't help if I can't make these videos and prove these cover-ups. I need financial help. If anybody's out there, they can come to my website, please.
Well, tell us what your website is so people can figure out how to help you keep going here.
It's helppa.org, helppa.org with 2 P's. And if you go there, there's a PayPal button on there. Every dime I get, I make public. I have a list of whoever's donated to me. Since January 1st, I've had $980 donated to me. And that sounds like a lot. The problem is I've spent over $9,000 out of my pocket. So I'm still $8,000 in the hole just since January. So I do need your help, please.
All right. Well, I hope people will help you out. I want to ask you as we get close to wrapping up here, what happened to your whistleblower lawsuit, and are you suing Enbridge?
What happened was, SCT Environmental was a subcontractor underneath Enbridge, and SCT didn't want me to go through with trial. I was about ready to testify, and I was offered a plea agreement, and the agreement was that they would not have a gag order on me, because that was that's major for me. I will never have a gag order, no matter how much money you offer me. And the second thing is that they said that they would testify under oath against Enbridge to the same stuff that they testified at depositions about. We were told to cover up oil from subcontractors and supervisors. So I could be a millionaire right now, everybody. I could be living in Florida with my family instead of being here in Michigan trying to help document this oil spill with no money. But the reason why I turned down that money, I'm going after Enbridge. So I took a small settlement, and I gave some money to my mom to help her with her house. I bought a camper and a truck so I could travel around and give speeches. And now I'm desperate for money because it wasn't that big of amount that now I sold my truck just so I could buy these $5,000 in signs that I give away for free, $10,000 in T-shirts that I give away for free. I'm not trying to make any money at this. I just would love to just have travel expenses. If somebody could help me with travel expenses, that's all I ask for.
You've got a lot of video getting ready here that you really could do a documentary. I've seen some of your videos, and there's a whole big, big story that could be wrapped up there if you can get the resources. As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to tell us?
Well, these oil companies don't care about us. All they care about is profits. And they're spending, I think it's in the last 10 years, they spent $42 million just giving money to politicians for their campaigns and stuff because they know they'll vote a certain way. I have videos of police officers, county commissioners, police chiefs, pastures, environmental inspectors. I have workers. I have dozens and dozens of sick people. I have many videos of them covering up oil. And I was arrested just for videotaping them digging up oil that they said that wasn't there. And I went to court to fight this, and Enbridge did not show up to court. So they dropped charges because I'm doing the right thing. And if you guys watch my videos, please pass them around because you don't have to believe anything I say. The videos of me exposing the truth with video proof, that's all you need to see.
We've been speaking with pipeline activist John Bolenbaugh from Kalamazoo, Michigan. On YouTube, John has dozens of revealing videos recording his whole battle with Enbridge and other pipeline giants. Find some links in my show blog at ecoshock.info or on John's website at helpa.org. That's helpa.org. Thank you, John, and never give up.
Thank you, and I'm not.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
On March 11, 2013, over 100 young people invaded the offices of TransCanada Pipeline in Westboro, Massachusetts. They were protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. They carried a coffin to symbolize the tar sands, burying our future.
They are digging us a hole. They are digging us a hole. 6 feet underground. We will lay down our bodies, we will lay down our souls. No, we won't stand by and watch while they dig us a hole. They are digging us a hole, they are digging us a hole. 6 feet underground where the pipeline will go.
We are here
to hold TransCanada responsible and accountable.
To hold TransCanada responsible and accountable.
For the degradation of our planet.
For the degradation of our planet.
And the impoverishment of our future.
And the impoverishment of our future.
We are here to amplify the cries.
We are here to amplify the cries.
Of the people in frontline communities.
Of the people in frontline communities.
From indigenous peoples at the point of tar sands extraction.
From the indigenous people at the point of tar sands extraction.
To the black and Latina communities that sit at the fence lines of these refineries.
To the black and Latino communities that sit at the fence line of these refineries. We are here
to pledge our resistance.
To pledge our resistance
to the Keystone XL pipeline.
To the Keystone XL pipeline
and all tar sands development.
And all tar sands development.
We are here.
We are here.
And we will stay.
And we will stay
until this deadly pipeline.
Until this deadly pipeline.
And the whole planet
is on the brink.
Coming up, scientist Paul Beckwith on the Arctic emergency that is rearranging global weather.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot flinders spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?
While we were fed news about a new pope and the economic breakdown on the little island of Cyprus, a major event occurred almost unreported in the Arctic. It's a very bad sign. Let's go to Paul Beckwith. He's the PhD student and part-time professor of climatology and meteorology at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul is also a member of AMEG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you today, Alex?
Well, I'm doing okay. We're going to talk about the weather, I guess, as we get going here. I want to ask you first, though, what happened in the Arctic sea ice in the winter of 2013 that caused you so much concern?
Well, I think a lot of people, or most people, are aware of the massive melt, the record melt, which ended September 15th of 2012, and some of the reasons behind that rapid melting. And basically, the ice, you know, it reforms in the winter months as the sun drops below the horizon. However, this year, because there's kind of a memory effect, there was so little ice in September last year that the ocean water has warmed significantly, so it took longer for the ice to form. And there's not a lot of multi-year ice. It's mostly first-year ice that's formed. And the ice seems to be very thin and very slushy, not very strong. And then come, February, sort of early February, March, I think the ice formation was the strongest about mid-March or so. Although from February to March, there were significant cracks developing in the ice. The whole thing does move, but it didn't seem to have structural integrity this year. Normally, when the ice breaks up, it kind of, as the melt season starts, it kind of melts around the edges and decreases. But this year, the whole pack is basically shattered into pieces with many fractures and many small chunks and stuff. It's like a regime change in the way the ice melts.
And you sent me a video that looked like a big vortex swirl at the top of the world there. Was there a storm or something?
Yes, there was a, I believe it was about mid-January, there was a phenomena called a sudden stratospheric warming. And what happened is that the jet streams where they cross the Himalayas in Asia, they went more vertical than normal, and they carried a lot of air from the troposphere into the stratosphere. And that air went up into the Arctic and came down, and it basically shattered the Arctic polar vortex. So what that meant, because the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the planet, the jet stream is basically slowing down and becoming wavier. And when the sudden stratospheric warming event occurred, it basically sliced the jets. So there was a huge high-pressure ridge across the Arctic. And basically, the jets normally confine cold air to the Arctic and its warmer air further south. But because they were disrupted, we basically had a leak of cold air out of the vortex into southern latitudes. So, for example, Britain had their coldest spring in 50 years, or maybe it was 100 years. And the Arctic is much warmer than normal, and further south it's much colder than normal. So there's been a complete disruption of the climate system over the last several months, and it's still continuing.
Right. I mean, people in the UK, Germany, Eastern Europe, they'd love to have some more global warming right now. The nasty winter they just had. In Ottawa, you just got snow in the middle of April. So you think the Arctic is partly to blame for this weird weather?
Yes. I think people need to kind of change their frame of mind on what is happening. You know, in the past, climatologists and meteorologists have always said there's a distinct separation between the two fields, and you can never attribute a particular weather event to climate. But what's happening is the climate system, the atmosphere ocean system, has changed, so the background has changed. So therefore, everything is off the table in terms of our previous thinking. You know, we need to think of, you know, when the background climate system is different than weather events that occur, whether it's frequency of extreme events, duration of extreme events, spatial location of extreme events, all that can change. So the Arctic has a huge impact on, certainly on Northern Hemisphere weather, but also it extends into the Southern Hemisphere. There's linkages to the Southern Hemisphere as well. Like, for example, to the growing sea ice in Southern Hemisphere winters. That can be related, too, because the Arctic is warming from increased absorption of sunlight because the albedo is collapsing. So basically, the sea ice decline and the snow cover decline is making it a darker. The average reflectance of the Arctic region is lower, so there's more sunlight being absorbed, so we're getting heating. Very high relative heating there compared to the equator, which decreases the temperature gradient, which makes the jet stream slow and go away there. So there's less need for heat to move from the equator up north via the atmosphere and ocean current. So more heat moves to the southern hemisphere. And because Antarctica is kind of isolated, the temperature gradient, so the southern hemisphere is warming because more heat is being carried down there, but that heat can't make it past the large circumpolar ocean currents and atmospheric jets in the southern hemisphere. So it increases the temperature gradient and increases the speeds of those winds, which causes cooling on the surface of Antarctica, which causes the increase in the sea ice there. And also the sea ice is melting, so there's a layer of sort of a lens of fresh water under the ice, which is disrupting the vertical mixing of the ocean. So then we get into things like the meridional ocean circulation patterns, and those are also being affected by what's going on. So you need to consider various aspects of the system to get a good picture. I mean, there's a lot of different components, and most people, you know, most scientists haven't come to grips yet with the extent of the changes.
Well, as you know, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has just released a study predicting the Arctic will be almost ice-free in the next decade or two. Their work is published online in Geophysical Research Letters, and it says the event is no longer a matter of if, but when. How soon do you think it could happen?
Well, first, a little bit about that NOAA work. They used their models, right? And the model still said 2050. So then they went and they looked, they kind of tweaked their models and came up with the 2030 number. And then looking at the actual data as opposed to the models, they came up with their 2020 number. But if you look at the PO mass, the volume data, it basically showed that there was a 5% chance of 2013 having no sea ice in September at the end of the melt season, 50% chance with 2015, and greater than 95% chance with 2018. Now, based on the behavior of the sea ice over the winter, and based on this new regime of cracking and weakening of the ice, you know, at the time of the year when the ice should be the strongest, which is March, right, at the end of the freezing season, I think that there's a very high probability that the ice could completely vanish from the Arctic by this September. What it would require for that to happen is if there were, last year, there were some very extensive duration, very powerful cyclones that churned up the sea ice, broke it up into small chunks, which increased the surface area and increased the melting. It also ripped large pieces of ice off and sent it to lower latitudes where it melted. And it also caused upwelling of warm water from below. There was vertical warm water was moving up from depths of 500 meters, which is very surprising to people. also you get a storm surge with a cyclone. And it was estimated that the storm surge was about a third of a meter. So when that water is being pulled up by the cyclone, then warm water has to go into the Arctic basin through the Bering Strait and also through the on the Atlantic side. And this warm water would also contribute to the melting. So there's all these factors. So when you incorporate all these factors, you know, we're obviously in a very abrupt regime change in the ice. So certainly, I would say that the models are not the way to go. If you need to really look at the data and what's going on, and based on that, I think there's a good chance that this year it could go, if not certainly in the next year or two. So the NOAA stuff is getting, I think it's getting closer to reality, but I don't think it's quite there yet. I think they're still going to get surprises from what they're saying.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Paul Beckwith, a climate scientist at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul, you've joined other scientists like the Cambridge Arctic specialist Dr. Peter Wadhams and concerned activists in AMIG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Is this really an emergency, and what is new with AMIG?
It's interesting because AMIG basically started, it was about November 2011. I think there was a small conference, a small group of people that got together and decided to form the group because they were so concerned about the rate of decline of sea ice in the Arctic and other things, the methane coming up in particular. I found out about the group December 2011 and joined. And, you know, over the last year and a half, I mean, we've met various politicians. We've tried basically to educate people, alert people to the rapidity of changes in the system with the sea ice, with methane emissions greatly increasing, and so on. Now, Peter, he's sort of a hands-on scientist. He's been on many submarine trips under the Arctic sea ice measuring thicknesses. He's been doing it for 30-plus years. So there's not too many people that know more about the ice, sea ice than him. And, you know, we're all sort of on the same line of thinking that it's happening very, very quickly. So he and some other AMIG people in Britain went in the British Parliament. I did it in the Canadian Parliament. But they went, and the British Met Office has a lot of pull, and they went and spoke to British Met Office people and said what was going on. And they were basically, people didn't want to believe the message that was coming out. So it was kind of discounted, and the Met Office had the view that, you know, the models are correct. It's going to be 2050, 2070 time frame. But what's happened in Britain with having the record, the coldest spring, because of the very strange jet streams and, you know, from the lack of sea ice, that they've, just in the last week, they've kind of changed their tune. And Julius Slingo, the head scientist there, has called a meeting of world experts on sea ice and to get them all together to find out what's going on, because she's obviously the type of weather that's resulting in Britain has been a huge problem. I saw a report that said that in the morgues, the mortality rates have jumped very, very high in the last several months because of this coldness. In fact, I saw numbers, you know, greater than 5,000, 10,000 people. So the number being killed above and beyond the normal mortality rate, mostly pensioners and older people. I mean, some of the homes in Britain don't have proper heating. They don't expect that. So, you know, this hasn't, the final count and the final numbers on this haven't come out. But this is, you know, very, very concerning stuff, you know. And of course, the U.S. drought. I mean, if NOAA also said that the U.S. drought, they didn't think it was connected too much to what's going on, but I don't see how they can get that conclusion. I mean, we know that the heat wave in Russia and the flooding in Pakistan was just these stuck jet stream patterns. So it's affecting people now. Food is going to be a big issue. I mean, there has been warnings from the UN and other people about food supply problems even later this year or next year.
Yes, some of these warnings published in the British papers say millions will die from food shortages due to climate change. Well, now I want to ask you, Dr. Ken Caldera is a top-ranked atmospheric scientist with the Carnegie Institution. He's been an IPCC lead author. Caldera is calling for emergency action to cool the Arctic by spraying aerosols into the atmosphere. Is Ken a member of AMIG, and do you agree this is necessary?
I don't believe that Ken is a member of AMIG, But this idea of the necessity of cooling the Arctic, sort of regionally cooling it, to buy a bit of time for us to slash emissions, you know, it's kind of a choice. I mean, do we just let the Arctic melting proceed? Because what you have to remember is that the sea ice in the Arctic provides air conditioning to the Northern Hemisphere. It takes an awful lot of energy. Like, for example, let's say you supply 1 unit of heat to 1 gram of ice, and it melts that ice. Well, the next unit of heat, you know, the same unit of heat that you apply to that water will warm that water 80 degrees Celsius. So that's the type of thing. So as long as you have ice there, the heat is going into melting the ice. When the ice is gone, the heat is going into warming it. And like I say, that 1 gram of water will warm 80 degrees. So when the sea ice is gone, then the warming will greatly accelerate. And then we have to really worry about the cascading effects on methane emissions and also on Greenland. I mean, Greenland is not doing very well. West Greenland, most of the snow covering the ice has already melted. And I've been checking the temperatures in Newark, Greenland, and those temperatures are about the same as Ottawa. The highs each day for the last 3 weeks have been above zero, between, you know, about 5 degrees C or something, the highs. The lows are close to zero or a couple of degrees below. But this is very unusual, and this was due to a high-pressure ridge that was sitting over Greenland. So there's a lot of melt already on the surface of Greenland, and it's very early. So AMEG's been pushing for some regional cooling via geoengineering. The quickest way to do it, and the way that we know most about, is through sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere, just right over the Arctic region in the summer to cool that particular region.
Well, some scientists have doubts about this kind of geoengineering, saying it could have unforeseen consequences. You mentioned the UK Met Office. Jim Haywood of that office just wrote in the journal Nature Climate Change, such fine particles sprayed into the atmosphere could increase horrible droughts in the Sahel region of North Africa. Have you read about that?
Yes. I mean, the Sahel is a very sensitive region because the intertropical convergence zone, which sort of travels around the equator, you know, very moist air, it kind of fluctuates around that region. So if it's a little bit too far south, it's drought there. And if it's, you know, where it's supposed to be, then the region is still marginal in terms of water. So what they did is they looked at rainfall and droughts in that region with volcanoes going off, because when big volcanoes go off, they can inject sulfur dioxide and ash up into the stratosphere and affect the climate. So they looked at El Shaishan, which was 82, 83, Mexico. They looked at Pinatubo in 91. They also looked at, I think it was Aguada in 1815. Now, the thing about volcanoes and their effect on the climate is it really depends on the latitude of the volcano. So the Mexican one and the Indonesian one in 1815, those ones were very close to the equator. So it really depends on the latitude. So putting the sulfur dioxide at the North Pole, or, you know, in the far north, it has quite a big difference than having it closer to the equator.
Well, fair enough. Now, Paul Beckwith, you must be aware, even talking about this will trigger another popular internet meme that governments have been secretly spraying materials into the atmosphere for years. It's the chemtrail conspiracy theory. What do you make of that?
Well, I've always been very skeptical of that because I haven't seen... I mean, I have tried to read and see if there was a lot to it. And like, for example, one of the claims is that if you're spraying stuff into the atmosphere, then you have to be able to detect it in the soils and so on. And I have seen a study that showed there was some aluminum and barium and higher levels. Yeah, I don't know if it was really confirmed or whether it was just, you know, one particular study. I mean, you kind of have to ask, if stuff is being sprayed, then why is it being sprayed? I mean, if it's being sprayed to cool the planet, then, you know, that's the problem, because it's not working, right? So, you know, one of the things is, because the atmosphere is warmer, because we've warmed the planet about 0.8 degrees in the last 100-odd years, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. In fact, there's about 4% more water vapor in the atmosphere than there was even 30 years ago. So what this could mean is that there's more contrails from aircraft and they last longer because there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. But I've seen some of the satellite images of the crisscross trails over cities and things, and it is a question. But, I mean, if they're spraying, then there has to be instrumentation on aircraft. Like, surely people could investigate this and come up with, you know, absolute proof for if it is being done. And I haven't seen that, so...
Yeah, I mean, if there had been thousands of flights and thousands of people involved in it, somebody would have blurted it out. You can't keep a secret for decades.
No, you can't.
That's happening. But we do have to admit that governments are openly involved in some kinds of climate modification. Just look at the efforts by China, for example, to seed clouds during their drought in northern China. And the U.S. military has published documents about using weather as a weapon of war. Maybe we are already modifying the weather a little bit.
Yes, and I mean there's also a lot of reports about this HARP, which is basically using phased array radar sites to like kind of focus energy up into high atmosphere of the stratosphere to ionize particles, to ionize molecules and things, and create these ions. I'm not sure what they're actually studying, but I played around on Google Earth for a while back, and you could actually find different things that look like phased array antennas from Google Earth. So, what are they using these things for? I mean, we know that these programs do exist. You can find some government stuff, but there's almost no information that you can get on these things. So, again, quite often, there tends to be some truth behind some of these very persistent sort of long-term things. Although I think that Barack Obama was a U.S. citizen. He was born in the U.S.
Well, we can laugh about it. I think that the military people, or some of them anyway, with HARP would like to be able to send a storm over an enemy if they could, but I think it's premature to say that they're doing anything at this point. And that's just my opinion, and it's pretty hard to tell. But the real kicker in all this, Paul, is that humans are geoengineering the planet on a vast scale right now. You and I help to do it when we turn on the ignition in our cars. It's not about whether we should change the weather. We have changed the weather, and everybody knows it.
Yeah, exactly. And the amount of sulfur, I mean, we have smokestacks all over the planet on power plants, and when we burn coal, they have high concentrations of sulfur. So, the amount of sulfur going up into the atmosphere right now from our power plants, I mean, that far exceeds, the amount required to inject up in the stratosphere in the Arctic, for example, is minuscule compared to the amounts that we're putting in with our unplanned, these are side effects of our society, right, of our industry. We have been geoengineering. I mean, when people first cut down trees and converted it to cropland, I mean, everything has an impact. It's just, what's the magnitude of the impact? And when you talk about more and more people on the planet doing this sort of thing, the cumulative impact gets larger and larger, of course.
I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with the very well-informed Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul, for the record, and for listeners, I do oppose geoengineering at this point. I think we're too stupid to manage it and will likely make things worse. But on the other hand, as you say, if we just sit back and let this polar ice cap disappear, mass extinctions, including our own, seem likely. I don't see a good choice. Well, one thing that amazes me is the video you posted on the Sierra Club blog. It reappeared at elephantjournal.com, but can't compare with crazy cat videos for public attention on the net. I mean, Kim Kardashian's better known than what's happening in the Arctic. So what do you think? Are we just going to let this happen?
I think that people are starting to wake up. Global crop failure causing prices to spike up, not just double, triple, quadruple, something like that would do it. I think if the sea ice is completely gone in September of this year, that will do it. I mean, I think we're getting close to a tipping point or an abrupt change in human behavior on this, because it can't be hidden. Like, you can't have some corporation or some group of people spending millions of dollars to convince the public that this is not happening. I mean, I think a lot of people are starting to feel, there's something wrong. I just saw a report yesterday. I think they had 17 inches of snow, April 15th in the mid U.S. So it's quite far south. Like, so one weather event, yeah, you can't say it's really climate change. That's the traditional way of thinking. If you change the whole background system, I mean, Jim Hansen has done a lot of statistical studies, And basically, you're shifting the bell curve. I mean, the weather happened under this bell curve, and what you're doing is shifting the average to a higher temperature, and you're shifting the shape of the bell curve, so you're getting a lot more events, you know, at the extremes. So statistically, it's changing, and I think people are starting to get this feeling, you know, what the heck's going on, and starting to pay more attention to it. So that hopefully will lead to a price on carbon, like a fee and dividend is the ideal thing, right? You have a fee on carbon, but you have a dividend, so the money that you collect from the fee, none of that goes to the government. It all goes back to people, right? Allowing them to adjust their way of life so they use less fossil fuels and so on.
We're starting to run out of time, Paul. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk to us about?
I think it's important that people remember that this is a whole system, and there's lots of, you know, when you get down to the details of the system, the individual components, there's surprises, there's things you don't understand, but, you know, we're starting to, at least some of us are starting to get a better sort of feel for, you know, the whole picture, and we do have precedents for what's happened in the past. I mean, we have paleo records which show how quickly the temperature has changed from one state to another. So, and the models, if you talk to somebody and they say, oh, this isn't going to happen and I'm basing it on a model of the climate, then this is a real problem. Like, I'm very curious as to what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is going to do, because they produce their document. Their next document is due out either at the end of this year or early next year. And a lot of their projections and things are based on these models. And the models are broken for sea ice, and they're broken for emissions coming out. And they're—I mean, when I say broken, they're not predicting what's happening. So it'll be interesting to see. They have kind of a conundrum, because are they going to come out with a document? I mean, the sea ice could be gone in September, and then they'll have a document saying the sea ice will be gone in 2030 or 2040, right? Well, obviously, who's going to, you know, there's a problem there, right? So what are they going to say in their document? I mean, are they going to wait till they see what happens and then change their predictions? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, I mean, these documents coming out every 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, it doesn't make sense to operate that way. So I think they really need to rethink what they do and have, like, much more rapid response.
Well, I agree, and I have very low hopes for the coming publication from IPCC. I think that we are at an emergency point and that we need a full-time, fully paid group of scientists all over the world who are working in real time with what is happening and keeping us all up to date with it. You know, you can find Paul Beckwith's blog at sierraclub.ca and links to his articles, plus the papers we've mentioned in this interview, in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul is from the University of Ottawa in Canada. As always, it's been enlightening talking with you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Please support this program and all our nonprofit radio stations. Your help makes it happen. Find a list of the 67 stations broadcasting Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. Sign up for our worldwide weekly podcast. Please tell your friends about Radio EcoShock while there's still time to make the big change. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook and get all the links and commentary for this show in my weekly blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll try it again next week, assuming there is a next week. We go out with Venice Beat's version of 2525.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if a woman can survive, they may find.
Year 2525. If man is still alive.